So the subject is passive resistance, and the reading that we just considered simply sums up the entirety of what can be said on this topic. But let's consider it in a logical progression and see where we arrive, and possibly we can take away at least the process of thinking through it. Now, the first question we have to ask, of course, when we say passive resistance, is resistance to what, right? Now, almost immediately, I'm sure, to everybody, there arises a clear answer. I think we should stand corrected when we think about it that way, because essentially it is resistance to what we perceive as evil. Because clearly, what you may perceive as evil at some point in your life itself, through evolution, you may consider as being propitious even. In your own evolution, you may change these viewpoints of what is evil and what is good. And clearly, between people, what is one man's poison is another man's medicine, and so on and so forth. So we have to basically there postulate passive resistance to what you perceive as evil. And just in that admission that what you may perceive as evil is somewhat relative and subjective, in itself, there is an answer that active resistance to such a thing is inadmissible if there is no such thing as absolute evil and good. How can you differentiate? How can you make active resistance to one that is going to change, even in your own lifetime, for maybe yourself? So we leave it there. What is it that you're resisting? What you perceive as evil. Now, why is it important to talk about this at all, right? It occurs to the student that, you know, all of us living in this kind of conditioned personal existence, products of duality, essentially. Existence itself is a product of opposing forces, spirit and matter, spirit invested in matter and struggling to make its way, involution and evolution. And as such, we always have these lists of likes and dislikes. We're looking to get ourselves elevated above these dichotomies. But as long as we occupy this body, as long as we have this sense of separation and separateness, we will always have these dichotomous likes and dislikes. An observation of life, you will see, as people age, they get older, you will see that there is a sense of contentment that somewhat comes. You know, your likes can attenuate down, you can maybe achieve some of your dreams. There is a possibility for those likes to at least reduce, or you may even accept some of them as unachievable and in effect attenuate them. But you look at the bucket of dislikes, there is infinite possibility of input, stimuli, things that people can produce around you, circumstances that you do not control, that can influence or drive you towards disliking. So this bucket of dislikes is almost inexhaustible. So how you deal with it is something that you have to consider. It is not that you can somehow, like lice, the likes bucket, you know, it's like a bucket list you tick off and then you're somehow attenuated down. These will continue to be something that you'll have to deal with. It is the kind of nature of life that there is always opportunities for lessons to be learned, and it comes from this bucket that we call dislikes, that we can name evil. Now, there is a certain difficulty that comes in talking about this subject, especially in a theosophical forum, because what we are seeing here is somewhat behaviorally oriented. It is what in the discursive subject of modern philosophy is called normative action, that which basically makes an ought statement. You ought to do something. The opposite of that is descriptive statements. Those are statements of fact, is statements. What is, right? You will see in theosophical literature, there's a lot of descriptive statements of the true nature of reality, as opposed to the elusive phantasmagoria that our senses bring to our consciousness. There is a true description of reality. But you will notice there is a paucity, if not a complete absence, of normative claims, normative statement, thou shalt do this or thou shalt not. On the other hand, though, if you look at any religious scripture, it's replete with such statements. We'll give a few examples. 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has given the 18 different aspects of yoga. And finally, in the 18th chapter, Arjuna stands enlightened. And yet Krishna says, yathechasi tatha kuru. Do as you see fit. There is an option given. No ought statements are even made at that point. We also see this in the Voice of the Silence. Third fragment. The candidate has surpassed trials past speech, stands enlightened, and yet the statement is made, thou art enlightened, choose your way. We also see in the Voice of the Silence that the path is one for all, but the means to reach the goal must vary with the pilgrim. There is that latitude. You don't see the similarities of the Ten Commandments of thou shalt do A, B, and C. So when we talk about normative, the subject matter we've taken up, we will also have to follow a similar pattern that lay out the descriptive claims of the nature of reality, the facts as they are, logically deduce from the facts the kind of action that is appropriate, but leave it to the individual to take the facts, apply it to their daily living life, as if you're taking the ore of gold that you dig up with all, you know, that's the knowledge that you're gathering, taking it into the furnace of man's life, as the Voice of the Silence says, with its black smoke and winged flames, and through trials, tribulations, and suffering, extract the gold, the soul wisdom out of it, which sears the soul with certain lessons that are indelible, that carries forward many lives. That is internally normative. It is not that somebody said, thou shalt not A, B, and C. You have come to the realization that this is the path that I am going to take. It is only through that action, that path, can normative claims be gained for yourself. So in this talk, we will maybe talk about certain modes of thinking, but, you know, and kind of conclude logically that perhaps, you know, passive resistance to evil is the right course of action, but leave it to the listeners to take this, apply it to their daily lives, and come to their own conclusions. Okay, so we said passive resistance to evil. So it behooves us at the outset to define evil. There is, in theosophical literature, a very, I think, nuanced and perhaps the only, in the student's experience, definition of evil and its origin thereof. Now, most, if not all, apocalyptic religions, apocalyptic not in the sense of, you know, bad things happening, that also is true, but apocalypse from a Greek meaning of revelation, most religions of revelation have a very clear kind of distinction between good and evil, also because there is this very clear commandments that come from this epistemological idea that there is such a thing as objective morality, right? There is a certain objective ontological existence for evil and a separate ontological existence of good. I mean, God and Satan, or however you may think of it. There is hell and heaven. These are very clearly kind of enunciated as having separate existences. But it immediately, when you think about it, it doesn't logically follow. We've talked about this many times. If there is infinite good, there is no space for any evil. But how is there evil in the world? And that explanation, if you, you know, all of these type of dichotomous, independent ontological existence type doctrines come short of answering. In theosophy, we see the following. We see first that life is evincing a progressive march towards a higher life. There is constant perfection that is ongoing in nature. And that is the law as we see it. You see it in nature and you embody it yourself. But how is perfection achieved in nature? If spirit is one, how is perfection brought about, right? How is it progressive, unitary, like monism? How can it become progressive? The answer is, in theosophy, is that, you know, progressive march to a higher life is evolution. But for evolution to be possible, first there should be involution, as in the one separates itself into the many. Spirit is invested in matter, and in that separation, in this idea of separation, through struggles, through karmic, its own karmic record, progresses and is redeemed through flesh. And through that process, there is what we talked about, this extraction of gold, this alchemy of conversion of lead into gold, of wisdom, of soul wisdom, which is an accumulation, which is a self-induced, self-devised effort. Through that effort, what has been reaped, that in its collective leads to this ever-increasing perfection. So we see this in the second volume of SD, which we have actually been considering in our Sunday morning study class, but I'll repeat this here for kind of brevity in how well it is expressed. So this is on page 95, second volume. It says, perfection to be fully such must be born out of imperfection. The incorruptible must grow out of the corruptible, having the latter as its vehicle and basis and contrast. Absolute light is absolute darkness and vice versa. In fact, there is neither light nor darkness in the realms of truth. Good and evil are twins, the progeny of time and space, under the sway of Maya. Separate them by cutting one from the other and they will both die. Neither exists per se. Per se, there's no ontological existence. Neither exists per se, since each has to be generated and created out of the other in order to come into being. Both must be known and appreciated before becoming objects of perception. Hence, in the moral mind, in our moral mind, they must be divided. Now, what we have essentially done by defining evil and its origin and its inseparability from good, as those two being two sides of the same coin that exists so long as we are in this world of duality, but in the absolute realms of truth, they are one. Light, absolute light is absolute darkness. Once we have defined this, what we have done is created for ourselves a moral landscape. We have at one end defined for ourselves separation, this what in the Voice of the Silence is called the great dire heresy of separation on the one end, which is, if you think of it, the origin of all evils, And on the other end, his benevolent, universal brotherhood, selflessness. You can think of it as heterogeneity and homogeneity. And so, as HBB said in the last sentence there, now we have this separation. We have, in this world of duality, this landscape where you more you move towards this idea of separation, the more you feel separate from others, the more evil it is. And the more you move towards heterogeneity, more towards universal brotherliness, there is that evolution. So you can think of it as involution and evolution. Those are the two sides of the same coin. Neither exists because it said it's in the realm of Maya, it's the progeny of time and space, and in under the realm of Maya. But in this existence, you define this moral landscape for yourself. Now, once we define this moral landscape for ourselves, we will have to ask this question: how do we perceive evil? Right? Part of existence, because you know the matter, the separation, the individuality that we have are all part of existence. Since it's inseparable and unavoidable, how do we deal with it? The first thing we should kind of think about before we answer this question for ourselves is how we deal with evil within us. Because anytime somebody says, passively resist evil, the immediate idea that you get in your head is, somebody is doing evil to me, how do I react to that? That's one question. Let's keep that aside. Every evil that you see outside of you is reflected in you in varying degrees of potentiality to actuality. If you spend some time to think about this, you will understand this as a reality, because for you to cognize something, for you to judge it, you have to have some reflection of it in you. Now, this is also why they say, if you expose yourself to, you know, crime novels, whodunit books of like murder mysteries and things like that, you're somewhat reliving those stories, you are reflecting it in yourself, you're bringing the seeds of what evil that you're reading in those books, which is innate in you, to sprout out and become trees. Same with this negative news cycle that we see these days. So, there is evil. Every evil that you see out there in potentia or even in actuality in varying degrees exists within you. That is kind of a humble admission that you have to first make. Then, the question is, how do you deal with evil within you? Let's first talk about that. What we see when we introspect on this question is we deal with ourselves with immense compassion. No man is without compassion. The self-regard that every man has is the utmost point of compassion that that person is able to express. In fact, if you think about compassion as a and chart it out, I think it will be like a what they call a Gaussian distribution, kind of a bell curve. In the middle, it's very high, and then it drops off quickly and almost goes to zero, even negative sometimes, as you away, the further away you go. And this mode or the top, the peak of that distribution lies your personal self. This idea of me on that pinhead, as light on the path says. Idea of this pinhead, one point, highest compassion for yourself. And then maybe your children, a little bit less, maybe immediate family, it drops off very quickly actually. And then your neighbor, you're already close to zero. When you go to the farther reaches, this othering becomes, you know, say these Pakistanis, negative, yeah, there's some hatred, you know, whatever it is, it maybe even dips into negative. So, how you're dealing with yourself, evil in yourself, is with that point. That's your reference point, highest compassion, right? So how do you, what are the things that we do? How do you, with this highest compassion that you are expressing for yourself, what is possible? Can you actively resist evil in yourself? Let's take a few examples. Let's take violence. We're all at some level predisposed to violence. In varying degrees, you may not pick up a gun and shoot anybody, but there will be some bodily reaction that seems kind of predisposed to violence, or even cognition of that. When you see things around you in response to stimuli, how do you react to that? Let's say you engage in some thoughts of violence. How do you counter that? Do you inflict violence on yourself? That's impossible. You're just basically, to counter internal violence, if you inflict violence on yourself, you're increasing the amount of violence overall in your system. Let's take anger. Can you be angry at yourself for being angry? That makes no sense. It's like you're compounding the amount of anger in your system. You're making this whole situation worse. So any kind of active resistance to evil that you find in yourself, you find that you don't do. You actually don't engage in it. So we can ask ourselves, okay, we cannot actively in ourselves resist evil. So what do we do? What can we do? We find that we passively resist evil in ourselves in one of three ways. The first thing we can do, and in many cases people do, is withdraw consent for that evil to express itself. What I mean by this is, you stop participating in that emotion that is driving the evil. Anything that you have is, any response that you have is based out of some stimuli, right? It needs the playground of the mind, of your mind, to express itself, to sprout, to become a tree. And as long as you provide that playground for it to engage in, you are sustaining it. You are actually giving consent to it. But you have full sovereignty over your mind, that playground. You can withdraw that consent, right? At that point, you will notice any stimuli may generate a response, some kind of anger or irritation, but it quickly dies down. The half-life of an emotion is what? Milliseconds maybe. But we find that people are angry for days. How is that possible? You have given consent. You have relived that experience. You have analyzed it. You have basically pitied yourself for like, what injustice has been done to me. The stimuli was milliseconds, it's just an electrical impulse. But then the response, who is sustaining it? We are sustaining it by giving consent for it to continue, to prolong. The half-life of any response is biologically extremely small. It's possibly in milliseconds. It is by our own anugraha, if you will, we are continuing it. So withdrawing consent, one. The second way in which you can counteract evil within yourself and evil tendencies is to counteract it. How do you counteract it? You counteract hatred with the opposite reaction, love. Violence with compassion. You are setting up a counter cause. So if you find yourself having evil thoughts, you immediately engender in and give, not only are you withdrawing consent, but you're pushing all that energy into the opposite, exact opposite emotion. There are lots of things that we are grateful for, that we, people that we love, and we can take all of that negative energy, the energy away from the negative emotions, and you can have this positive counteracting thought. You see people do this very successfully in practice, counteraction. Then there's a third way in which we can passively resist. And all of this, again, be cognizant of a passive resistance. We are not actively doing anything. It is all internal. So the third thing that you can do is sublimate it. meaning emotions or anger or evil arise at a certain level. They cannot be met at and neutralized at that level. What you're doing is you're approaching it from a higher standpoint. You're approaching it sometimes from the standpoint of reason, from the standpoint of wisdom. You're shining the light of knowledge and wisdom on it from your past accumulated wisdom. And you say, is this right? Right? And in the light of truth, in the light of wisdom, in the light of reality, these things fade. These things kind of dissolve away. William Q. Judge has a very clear and very nice, I think, or I would say more practical way of thinking about it, which is to extend love as though to an erring brother, that those through whom you see evil or perceive evil, you extend love as though of, you know, of a compassionate erring brother, brother pupil, who's off the path. You know, if your own brother is off the path, the kind of compassion you would have. That counteracts this type of reactionary evil that arises in you in response. So those are the three kind of ways in which internal evil can be, or we actively, or we passively deal with internal evil. We don't fight our internal violence with violence. We don't fight our internal anger with anger, and so on and so forth. Now, coming back to this Pareto distribution of compassion and the moral landscape we set out for ourselves, he said, moving more towards universal brotherhood, more selflessness, the expansive sense of self is the right direction to move in this moral landscape we set out for ourselves. So when you come back to this sense of compassion that you have for yourself, if you expand that sense of self away from that, you know, self on the thin head, you essentially broaden this curve. In concentric circles, you express the same compassion that you express for yourself to larger groups of people. Right? Your sense of self is expanding. It's not that you're saying I'm expressing compassion to another. You are seeing no difference there. In that circle, you're seeing no difference between yourself and this idea of difference. The separation is dissolving. In that sense, you will deal with external evil that you may perceive in the same way that you deal with internal evil when that happens. Right? When you move in the right direction in this moral landscape we set out for ourselves, we essentially deal with quote-unquote external evil in the same manner in which we deal with our internal evil, because we see no difference within that circle. And as that circle expands and the boundaries kind of disappear, that Pareto distribution becomes a straight line. That in Voice of the Silence is called compassion absolute. There is no relativity. Only when there's boundary is the relative, you know, self and non-self, as Descartes said, like Cartesian self and non-self. If that completely disappears, you have this equal-minded, equal, absolute compassion for everything, everybody. And in that repose, as we see in Tao Te King, you would deal with external evil as you deal with your internal evil. Now, how can that come about? Let's kind of take that and translate it one more level. What does withdrawing consent mean in an external situation? I think we have seen many examples in the past, in history, of very eminent people practicing this. Clearly, when there is any kind of external evil that arises, only an equal and opposite force is required for you to have aggressive conflict. For you to clap, you need two hands, or it takes two to tango, as they say. So in one-on-one interpersonal relationship, withdrawing consent is not rising up to the situation to meet that force at its level in its equal intensity. I have withdrawn consent to participate in the perpetuation of evil that I see, as I may perceive it. It is only, as we've said, by participating, and this is especially true in interpersonal relationship, it is only by mutual participation is that evil perpetuated. Otherwise, there is a stimuli, it just drops off, just like internally. Externally, you will see this happen almost invariably in all interpersonal relationships. At a wider scale, we see this being employed as civil disobedience. Henry David Thoreau, an American philosopher, wrote this seminal essay he called Civil Disobedience. In his time, America was engaged in a war against Mexico, and he said this is an unjust war. He didn't want to participate in it. You know what he did? He wrote to the government and he said, from today, I will not be following any civil duties imposed upon me that tacitly gets me to participate in the propitiation of this war, or the propagation of this war. He said, I will not pay taxes, but I'm telling you I'm not paying taxes. I mean, this is a very big, important difference here. We also know many people in India who say, the government is corrupt, why should I give my money to them? I won't pay taxes. And they will kind of defraud the government and try to hide the fact that they're not. This is not what he did. He said, openly he wrote to the government, said, no more am I participating in it. And I will be responsible for the repercussions of my actions. He was thrown in jail. He went through lots of tribulations in life. But he made that explicit claim. He said, I'm not going to participate. Of course, very famously, Mahatma Gandhi was inspired by Thoreau's writings and himself, started the non-cooperation movement, Satyagraha, civil disobedience, which won India its freedom. And in America, again, the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. used very similar methods. There was lots of violence being wreaked against people of color, but he didn't meet them at that same level. He didn't cause another civil war. But there was passive resistance to it, non-participation in that violence. Another very important figure who's not very popular, unfortunately, but whose writings are sublime, is Vaclav Havel of Czechoslovakia, which then later became Czech Republic. His writings and his civil disobedience and his withdrawal of consent to the powers that be to perpetuate the evil of, in that case, was a authoritarian government and with communist kind of ideology. It's just a veneer of communist ideology with authoritarianism being the ultimate goal. From jail, I mean, think about passive resistance. This person was completely jailed. He could have no possible active resistance ever. Wrote letters to his wife. I think it's called Letters to Olga. They were published, and one of the articles or essays that he wrote was called The Power of the Powerless. This person was as powerless as the person with least power in jail, political prisoner. The power he had in that, as Tao Te King says, in that inaction brought about a revolution that essentially overthrew the Czechoslovakian communist government and brought about the Czech Republic. And he was also the president of that country. And he continued to write, and those are beautiful writings. So you see here that the same kind of internal withdrawal of consent that we have while dealing with internal evil on the external field has a similar effect. We've seen in interpersonal and also at the larger kind of governmental or at the national level. Now, counteracting. I will state a personal anecdote of how you can counteract external evil. This happened to me in the inverse situation, where I was the one with evil intentions that were counteracted. This was in America. You know, anywhere you drive, road rage is an inevitability, unfortunately, no matter how well these road rules are established. Of course, here, it's a norm, I would say. Anyway, I was driving down one of the highways. There was a signal that was ahead of us. I was in my lane. There's lane discipline that is being followed there. Somebody kind of cut me off, meaning they just kind of entered into my lane at the very last moment. I had to brake to avoid an accident. Obviously, I was enraged. I flashed my headlights and honked at this person. What do you expect? Like, you'd expect them to kind of give you a route signal or what? And then you have some elevated negative emotions and you deal with it and you move on. That's not what this person did. This person moved their car out of the way to the neighboring lane so that I could, you know, pull up next to this person. He asked me to lower my window. I was ready for conflict. I was like, yeah, I know exactly how this plays out. Lowered my window. And this person said, I hope you have a nice day. That's all. The internal state that I had 1 millisecond before he said those statements and the 1 millisecond after, incomparable. It was so drastic that I let out a huge laughter. And I told him, I hope you have a great day too and continue this brotherly feeling that you have towards everybody. That was transformative, I think. Not only did this person diffuse that situation, I think to this day, I carry the lessons from that. And I try to pay that forward, that when I get into a confrontational situation, especially on the road, I try to counteract it with love, with understanding, with we are all in this together. I understand why this may have been painful to you. That, I think, counteracting has a very, very positive influence. It's also, again, what you do internally, same thing applies externally. And going back to that Gaussian distribution, the more you expand your sense of self, this comes naturally because you don't see that sense of separation dissolves more and more. You have the same sense of compassion that you feel for yourself. Right? Lastly, sublimation. How can you sublimate externally? Now, the student's feeling and thought is that what is sublimation? It is the application of some higher knowledge that you have gained and you shine that, right, on a situation. For that, you need to have these higher ideals, higher aspirations, higher thoughts, which society in general so abjectly lacks these days. So one of the best ways, I think, we as students of theosophy can do this is through the promulgation of the philosophy of theosophy to help spread the message of this higher this idea of this kind of external evil that you expect that what you have sown previously through this promulgation, through, you know, selflessly, and in fact our own founders of ULT and Theosophical movement, if you see, self-sacrificingly gave out to the world. That bears fruit because you've planted those seeds that's able to then sprout and shine that light. Just like internally, when you use sublimation as a technique, you have learned, you have, with self-effort, put those seeds there, put those lights there so that you can shine it when it is needed. The same thing you need to do in society. If you need to counteract evil through sublimation in society, you need to plant those seeds. It's your responsibility to spread this message. So when you expand your sense of self, you act to others as you would act on yourself. So the sublimation extends in the same way. Finally, I think we'll take this final point of view and close. From the law of karma, from the point of view of the law of karma, It is an impersonal, ever-acting, never-erring law which cannot be propitiated, which does not, it is undeviating and unerring in its restoration of disharmony to harmony. Now, from the eyes of such a law, active resistance to evil, to rise up and meet evil with equal force and opposite, you know, confrontation, is as evil as this evil that it is trying to counteract. There is no difference. You cannot, because if it's an impersonal law that sees no distinctions, that from a personal self, it was righteous anger that you may feel, such distinctions don't exist. Because in the realms of truth, such distinctions, these separations don't exist. So this law that is operating from that plane sees no difference. The retributive, you know, revengeful anger that you may have, that you feel is righteous, is not seen as such, cannot be seen as such. So what ends up happening is, not only are you earning for yourself some very reprehensible karma for your future, but also what ends up happening is, reading the Key to Theosophy, is that this person that you feel, that you perceive is the evildoer that you punish, you're actually, karma has to reward that person as a compensation for this overbearing kind of self-righteous justice that has been inflicted on them. Human justice is not the, we may feel this is the right thing for us to do, but we are seeing from a pinhole perspective. When you see, you know, life from a wider perspective, you immediately see that our idea of retributive justice is very narrow, very personally oriented, very, you know, is of the world of this separation in the one end of the moral landscape that we talked about. And from the eyes of karma, it becomes compensated, overcompensate for it, right? So you're actually doing a double whammy. You're incurring bad karma for yourself and compensating for this person that you perceive as doing evil, which is self-defeating. So even from that perspective, this is active resistance to evil, does not work. Now we'll take a few quotes, you know, where great personages in the past have kind of reiterated this stance, and we'll end. B.P. Wadia has made this beautiful statement, which is, inner living is your most pressing need. Without that, you will be caught in a maze of irritation, depression, and defeatism. Inner living. So active resistance to external stimuli is the exactly the opposite of that. In the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, now this is not it is an apocryphal gospel. A very startling statement is made. Mary Magdalene, this is, I think the setting is post-resurrection, Jesus leaves and is ascended to heaven, and the students are all, you know, fall down on their face, and the apostles are crying. Mary is the only one who's not. And then the apostles ask her, you know, you were the favorite student of Jesus, please teach us some of what he has said. And one of the first questions they ask is, what is sin? Like, what is sin? And the answer is, there is no sin. It's a very startling answer. And Jesus, his living words were, there is no sin, but what you do in what he called, I think he calls it adultery. The actions you commit in adultery. And adultery is in quotes. And what it means in the text is, in false identification of yourself in the flesh of matter in which you're enveloped. That false identification in his mind is adultery, because your real self, your real true self is not in that identification. When you kind of intermix with it and misidentify and get deluded in it and participate in its characteristics, that is adultery for him. So there is no sin, but what actions you take in adultery. So that is another very interesting statement. I think lastly, I think we should also say that I have to end with Vaclav Havel's quote, because this is, I would highly urge students to go back and try, you know, sample some of his writing. I'll leave you with this quote. The salvation of this human world lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human meekness and human responsibility. The salvation of this human world lies nowhere else than in the human heart, in the human power to reflect, in human meekness and human responsibility. So we'll end here and open the floor up for any contributions, questions, or discussions.